v. Bennett. Counsel for the appellant, please.
Chief Judge Baker, members of the court, my name is Major McCray Jones, and I, along with Major Ankenbrandt, represent Private Bennett. The sentencing landscape changed dramatically, and this court set aside Private Bennett's conviction for involuntary manslaughter. In reassessing the sentence, the Army Court used its discretion by considering evidence of LK's death in support of its decision to reaffirm Private Bennett's sentence for two main reasons. One, the Army Court's finding that Private Bennett was convicted of the distribution of oxymorphone to LK was wrong. And two, even if you disagree with the first assertion, evidence of LK's death is not admissible aggravation evidence under 1001B4. As to the first one, Private Bennett's conviction of the distribution of oxymorphone in violation of 112 alpha did not include the distribution to LK for four main
reasons. Can I ask you a question about the sales standard? When the CCA goes back and reassesses,
yes, sir.
They're supposed to be confident, I'm paraphrasing, be confident that the sentence adjudged would have been at least as much as would have been adjudged at the court, at the original court-martial. Is it the original court-martial that they're being confident would have adjudged the same sentence, or is it a court-martial? You see the question? Are they supposed to say, we are confident, or whatever the standard is, that this particular military judge would have given at least as much sentence? Or are they supposed to say, we are confident that a court-martial, knowing our knowledge of courts-martial, would have given just as much sentence?
Your Honor, it would be a court-martial, but it would be based on the appropriate aggravation evidence that would have been before the court.
Do you understand the difference? One is them trying to figure out what this particular military judge would have done versus what the average military judge would have done. It's a question, not a statement. Because I don't think the sales line of cases is entirely clear on that. And the reason it's relevant in this case is because the military judge said, which we don't usually have, the military judge said something to the effect of, I'm only going to sentence you for the things you've been convicted of.
Yes, Your Honor.
But if the sales standard merely says to the CCA, what would the average or court-martial have done, it doesn't really matter what that particular military judge said.
Your Honor, but it does also bring into some of the factors that they have to consider.
Okay, but just to be clear, your answer to that question was that under sales, the CCA is supposed to ask themselves, what would a average or reasonable or regular court-martial have done?
What the court-martial would have done with the appropriate...
This court-martial or a court-martial?
What a court-martial would have done, presented with the appropriate aggravation evidence.
And when you say that, are you saying that because I asked the question, you have to come up with some answer? Or are you basing that on, based on this text from this case or this text from that case or whatever?
Your Honor, that I'm basing that also on some of the Winkleman factors, one of which talks about the significant aggravating circumstances that were considered at the court-martial. So the court-martial would have presented before it the appropriate aggravation evidence. And in this case, the appropriate aggravation evidence would not include evidence of LK's death.
Which is a separate issue.
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay, thank you.
Your Honor, as to argument one, in that Private Bennett's distribution of oxymorphone on specification 3, charge 2, did not include the distribution to LK, I said there were four main reasons that support that. One, you look to Private Bennett's plea inquiry, where he specifically discusses the distribution of oxymorphone to three soldiers on February 14th, 2009. He did not admit any distributions of oxymorphone to LK. Two, you also look at what the military judge told the government and the defense. Here, the military judge expressly told the defense and the government, if you want to consider misconduct as charged misconduct, then you have to go forward on the merits, and Private Bennett needs to be convicted of that. The military judge also told the accused, I want to be very clear, that you cannot be sentenced for anything you're not found guilty of. That includes if you're found guilty of misconduct, during a charged period of time, and they want to punish you or bring up some conduct that happened during that period of time that you haven't pled guilty to. If they haven't proved it, you can't be punished for it. Knowing this, the government, when asked what charges do you intend to go forward on, the government chose only to go forward on the merits with respect to the involuntary manslaughter charge, which is charge one, under the culpable negligence theory and also the crime directly affecting the person. And they chose to go forward with respect to certain crimes under 112 alpha, specifically the use offenses, for use of marijuana and use of oxymorphine, which was specifications 5 and 6 of charge 2. They did not choose to go forward with respect to charge 3, which is the distribution charge. And then 4, the judge's findings are actually in concert with the appellant's guilty plea. The judge here specifically found that he accepted the words between, and he also accepted the words in the figures on or about 15 February, and he found Private Bennett not guilty of the accepted language. Here, nothing prevented the government from pursuing Private Bennett's conviction of oxymorphone 2LK. They simply chose not to go forward with respect to specification 3 of charge 2. Further, Your Honor, the Army Court's finding that Private Bennett was convicted of the distribution of oxymorphone to LK also rests on an erroneous view of the law. By expanding Specification 3 of Charge 2 to include LK, the Army Court found Private Bennett guilty of distributing oxymorphone to LK under a theory that was not placed before the prior effect. Appellate courts are not free to revise the basis of which a defendant is convicted simply because the same or similar result may be obtained on retrial. Here, that theory was not placed before the trier of fact. Further, if you look at the arguments that were placed before the Army Court on appeal, the government never claimed on appeal Private Bennett was convicted of distribution of oxymorphone to LK under Specification 3 of Charge 2. On appeal, the government specifically argued that the question in this case depends on whether the evidence of the appellant's distribution to Ms. LK are directly related to or resulting from his other distributions and uses. Those other distributions and uses would be what he was convicted of, the distributions to the three soldiers. So they essentially conceded that he was not convicted under Specification 3 of Charge 2 of the distribution of oxymorphone to LK. We are going to the second reason why, with respect to the admissibility of the 1,194. Regardless of whether or not Private Bennett was convicted of the distribution of oxymorphone to LK, a plain language reading of the directly relating to a resulting from language in RCM 1001B4 makes evidence of LK's death and the corresponding.
Can you speak up a little?
Yes, Your Honor. Regardless of whether or not Private Bennett.
Thanks.
Was convicted of the distribution of oxymorphone, a plain language reading of the directly related to resulting from language in RCM 1001B4 makes evidence of LK's death and any corresponding victim impact evidence inadmissible.
Okay, what about 1001F2, which says that in determining an appropriate sentence, court martial may consider any evidence properly introduced on the merits before sentencing? Wasn't his confession in there?
Your Honor, on the Army Court specifically in their findings found that this evidence was appropriate evidence under 1001B4. So they categorized this evidence as aggravation evidence that came in under 1001B4.
Well, can it come even whether it's aggravated, whether it's proper aggravating evidence or not, can it come in under F2? Because the confession's in there. I'm not talking about whether they convicted him or not. But isn't the confession in there, and can't they, under F2, consider it in determining an appropriate sentence?
Your Honor, things brought in on the merits under F2 could be considered, but what cannot be considered is basically all of the victim impact evidence if you look at F2. So all of the testimony that came in terms of the family.
Yeah, okay. So what you're saying, I think, is the confession may be considered, the rest of it may not.
If it was properly...
Assuming arguendo. Is that what you're saying?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay.
But, Your Honor, with respect to, I guess, the the stuff that came in on the merits, the military judge did specifically find him not guilty of the culpable negligence version of the manslaughter.
Mm-hmm.
And then this court also set aside the finding of manslaughter. So we're arguing that he should be sentenced on things that he was convicted of and not things that would no longer be basically before the court.
So what you're saying really, I think, is that regardless of what F2 says, the fact that we threw out this thing should insulate it from being used in any manner?
For a if there were a sentence reassessment or a sentence rehearing, what would be considered? For
in determining an appropriate sentence. And, of course,
yes,
under 66, if it's at the ACCA, they've got a responsibility to find the sentence is appropriate.
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay.
Your Honor, with regard to the plain language reading, like in Farage, the record in this case does not establish that Private Bennett's conduct was but for cause of LK's death. And the facts that support that are, one, LK clearly died from a lethal drug combination. She died from both a combination of alprazolam and oxymorphone. Two, there was no evidence on the record at all that this plan distributed alprazolam to LK. The military judge specifically, when he found the appellant guilty of involuntary manslaughter under specification 2 of charge 1, accepted the words and alprazolam and all of the related scheduling information and found him not guilty of those accepted words. The appellant was not the only source of oxymorphone that LK ingested. There's evidence on the record that she snorted Opana, which is the street name for oxymorphone, at around noon that time, on her own, not brought to her by the appellant, and potentially again at 2100, around the same time frame. There's no evidence in the record that oxymorphone would independently cause LK's death, and the toxicology expert was unable to determine how much oxymorphone or alprazolam could have been a lethal dose, when the congestion would have occurred. All of those facts demonstrate that Private Bennett's specific conduct was not but for the cause of LK's death. And in Mirage, the court found that the plain language reading of a phrase like results from imposes a requirement of actual causality. And not only results from, but also similar words like because of, based on, and by reason. All of those import a actual causality requirement. Similar to the results from phrase that was in the SEA, addition of Barrage, 1001 as a whole does not define the phrase directly relating to or resulting from. The text of RCM 1001b4 is not ambiguous, and absent any contextual indication to the contrary, within the bounds of 1001, the court should import an ordinary meaning of the words. Accordingly, Your Honor, I believe this court should find that the President promulgated 1001b4 intending to impose actual causality. And the act of court here defining that all consequences associated with Private Bennett's drug distribution should be considered as aggravation of incident. Army Court abused its discretion, and this court should set aside the sentence and remand the case for a sentence rehearing. Subject to any further
rehearing, reassessment, what?
Your Honor, I would argue that a rehearing is more appropriate because of the
Well, I'm not going to get into beat my drum on rehearing, so
yes, sir.
Thank you.
And Your Honor, I would like to reserve the remainder of my time for rebuttal.
Noted. Okay, thank you. Counselor, for the, I'm still worried about what drum was going to be beaten there.
Do you really want me to?
No, okay. Sorry. I was doing a dramatic internal reading here. Counselor for the government, please.
Thank you, Chief Judge Baker, members of the court. I'm Captain Carrie Warren with Captain Jenny LaPierre. We represent the United States. This is not a case in the regular course of appellate review, meaning that we are not here to revisit the issues of factual or legal sufficiency. This is strictly a review of the Army Corps' decision to conduct a sentence reassessment. The standard of review on that question is whether the service court committed an obvious miscarriage of justice or abuse of discretion. I ask you to recall that the basic facts in this case were reflected in a charge sheet that was designed to follow a single course of conduct. Multiple acts committed by the appellant over one night.
Can I ask you the question I asked the appellant?
Yes, sir.
That in the reassessment, is the CCA trying to determine with confidence what this particular trial would have done or what a trial would have done?
Yes, Your Honor.
You followed the difference between trying to figure out what this particular judge would have done versus a random judge selected from a pool of randomness.
Yes, Your Honor. Under sales, I think that question is somewhat ambiguous, but it was later clarified in Winkleman when you articulated the factors that a service court should consider, suggested to consider when deciding to engage in a sentence reassessment. One of the questions is, one, was it a military judge alone or was it a panel of members? An Army Service Court is much better suited to reassess a military judge's opinion, so you get closer to the analysis of that particular military judge because of the judicial temperament and being able to bifurcate their mind with legal sufficiency versus factual sufficiency. That said, the overall standard, I believe, is a reasonableness standard, not necessarily to reconstruct what that particular mind would have done, but a reasonable assessment of the facts and circumstances that are properly under review.
So a military judge, not that military judge.
Yes, Your Honor.
And if you were writing on a clean slate, which would you think is the better outcome in terms of the law? You said if it were ambiguous and you were the government and you got to write that particular military judge or a military judge, which would you do?
Your Honor, I would do a military judge.
Okay, thank you.
And you're arguing, I think, from what you said before you answered the question, that the standard to be applied here is the extremely deferential standard we use on reviewing or not reviewing most of the time Article 66 decisions on appropriateness by the Courts of Criminal Appeals?
Yes, Your Honor.
That's the standard?
Yes, Your Honor. Okay. And I believe that standard was well established starting with Jackson v. Taylor, and then as we go through the cases and military jurisprudence that talk about sentence reassessment versus sentence reassessment.
No, I know the standard. I'm just saying that's what the government's position is.
Yes, Your Honor. Okay. That we've imparted an even higher standard than just simple abuse of discretion. We're looking for agreement.
Well, isn't it lower than abuse of discretion?
Defend an obvious miscarriage of justice?
You're right.
Your Honor, I would think not. The language in Winkleman was a broad, broad deference, and then looking for an obvious miscarriage of justice or an abuse of discretion.
Well, I won't occupy you any further.
Yes, Your Honor. So if we can go back to just reviewing what the basic facts were in this case, considering this under the charge sheet as it was drafted in a singular course of conduct. The charges are multiple acts that were committed by the appellant, most of which were pled to by the appellant. Those facts include going to his dealer's home, who he was introduced to by his 16-year-old girlfriend, seeing his 16-year-old girlfriend at that location snorting Xanax earlier in the day on the 14th of February, purchasing multiple pills of oxymorphone, which is a neurotic depressant, distributing those pills on diverse occasions throughout the barracks to various soldiers.
Counsel, you earlier argued that we weren't here to review the facts that occurred down there. All we're here to review is the CCA's reassessment determination. What's the purpose of giving us a factual background at this point?
Yes, Your Honor. Because the appellant has argued that there seems to be some factual insufficiency or an impropriety in considering the facts and circumstances that surround the death of Ms. LK, and then questioning whether or not this was a charge sheet that was drafted to concern a singular course of conduct. So considering all those facts as they should be considered, is at his discretion. So with the fact that the service court has the ability to reach factual conclusions, and the fact that they articulated these factual bases why they felt that the aggravating factor of Ms. LK's death remains admissible under a variety of theories, just keeping those facts in the forefront of your mind as we walk through the various issues that affect the actual sentence reassessment itself.
What was the theory for the involuntary manslaughter conviction?
The theory for involuntary manslaughter was that it was a distribution and then it had the additional element.
Now, I thought it was aiding and abetting. Where do you get the aggravated distribution that you argued in your brief? What is the aggravated distribution of drugs?
The aggravated distribution of the drugs. Well, as it was already in the first round when it came up here to question what the legal sufficiency of the involuntary manslaughter, the appellant actually conceded that the distribution did occur to Ms. LK. The argument on that in that brief questioning legal sufficiency for manslaughter was that it was a simple distribution, and he conceded that he should be held accountable for the distribution to Ms. LK, but that it didn't reach the level of involuntary manslaughter, meaning that there wasn't that extra step to get to directly affecting her person. The government's theory was that the extra step was the crushing of the pill. This court found differently and overturned it for legal sufficiency. But the act of distribution was still a necessary element under the manslaughter charge, and it's a parallel theory of admissibility and liability to specification for your charge, which discussed distribution of that specific drug on that specific date span and would necessarily include the distribution to Ms. LK. The evidence of the distribution to Ms. LK for both of those charges was found in the confession, and then also, again, in a defense witness, Ms. Yochum, that testified that the drug was imbibed by Ms. LK on the 14th of February.
But you don't disagree that he wasn't found guilty of distribution to LK?
Sorry, sir, I don't disagree that he was.
I mean, the trial court did not find him guilty of distribution to LK.
Well,
he accepted the 15th from his plea, and the military judge accepted that.
Yes, Your Honor, he did. But specification 3 of charge 2 actually addressed distribution on adverse occasions, and then as found guilty, limited to the 14th of February. There was factual support in the record that she did imbibe the drug that was given to her by the appellant on the 14th of February. Without a request for special findings or even a prior request for a bill of particulars, there's no evidence to assume that he wasn't convicted of distribution to Ms. L. Davis. Now, so Ms. L. K. as an additional incident.
Wait a minute. There's no evidence to disprove it. The government's got the burden of proving beyond a reasonable doubt. The defense has no burden.
But yes, Your Honor, I agree. And he was convicted of distribution on diverse occasions on the 14th of February. The government proceeded with a trial on the merits that included significant evidence that regarded the distribution of Ms. LK, two pieces of which addressed the distribution on the 14th. Even assuming that is what the Army Court found in its opinion when it wrote a memorandum opinion after the motion to reconsider the sentencing assessment, that it was necessarily included under the theory for involuntary manslaughter and was considered as charged misconduct under the date span as drafted under Specification 3 of Charge 2. So, and then the Army Court went further, even assuming that this wasn't properly considered as an additional incident under the plea, even though the government did go forward on the merits, you're talking about a span of maybe an hour and a half. Any other evidence, you're talking about something where she possibly imbibed at about 1 o'clock in the morning on 15 February. Although that evidence at that particular hour came from an earlier statement of the appellant, which was negated by his later confession.
You lost me about 5 minutes ago, but go on.
Bob, why don't you state then... reload the deck. Why was or was not he convicted of distribution to LK?
It is the government's position that he was. That the evidence is factually supported in the record that she did ingest the drug that was given to her as conceded by the appellant on the 14th of February. Those two pieces of evidence that are in the J are his confession and then the testimony of the defense witness, Ms. Yakin, that confirms that she ingested at 11:30 p.m. on the 14th.
And that gets it within the diverse occasions on the 14th.
Yes, Your Honor. However, assuming that this court does not want to go that far and not find that it was a final conviction, although I would disagree, we can look at the appropriateness of considering her death in aggravation. Really, as we look at how you classify that evidence, the appellant has classified the death of Ms. LK and distribution of Ms. LK as uncharged misconduct. It was conceded at trial that additional evidence that was presented by the government on the merits, specifically regarding additional acts of distribution, would be properly considered for aggravation on sentencing because it is not uncharged misconduct. So if the government went forth on the merits and presented the evidence such that it did, and then the only thing the defense attorney at trial asked the judge was to give it its due weight and credibility. So to term it under uncharged misconduct is a misnomer. As I pointed out in the government's brief, it is constitutionally appropriate to consider acquitted conduct because the The fact finder should have the benefit of the full nature and circumstances of the appellant's misconduct when rendering an opinion.
Now, are you still relying here during oral argument on Burrage, which you cited in your brief?
Am I relying on Burrage?
Yes.
No, sir. I believe that was better cited by the appellant.
I'm sorry.
And I do not rely on Burrage.
Right. Okay.
I actually think Burrage is quite distinguishable. They do address the getting to the question of whether or not the but-for language, the plain meaning of the words but-for, is applicable to R1001, directly related to or resulting from. I disagree. Burrage is actually distinguishable in that the holding was limited in that case to a mandatory sentence. So there should be an elevated standard when an additional element that but-for creates an aggravating factor such that the government is essentially held to an additional element. If it increases the criminal liability, then the government should be held to that standard, much like in 1006, we have aggravating factors for death penalty cases. It is also distinguishable in that when they discuss the plain language of what is a but-for, they do talk about resulting from, but nowhere in the Burrage case is it mentioned the words directly related to. And 1001 uses or. So if you have directly related to or resulting from, that clearly intends that there are two different theories of admissibility for aggravating evidence. And as our controlling opinion, such as Vickers outlines, it is proper to consider the full nature and circumstances of the actual misconduct. So under the idea of continuing misconduct, the course of conduct, this again remains admissible for consideration on sentence.
To what extent? We threw it out because we said it didn't involve the person. Yeah. If he's flatly acquitted of it at trial, say, can you still do it?
Well, yes. The involuntary manslaughter charge was thrown out for legal insufficiency.
Right. Say he had been acquitted of it at trial. Would that have made any difference?
I think we'd have, honestly, Your Honor, no.
It would. Okay. So basically, you've got free rein to drag in anything he was acquitted of on the merits in sentencing?
No, Your Honor. What I believe would have changed, if the military judge had acquitted him of manslaughter, you probably would not have had the three witnesses testifying to victim impact. So the mother, the grandmother, and the sister of Ms. LK did testify. But that's a whole case spectrum. So the military judge... that was only 13 pages of testimony. The closing argument that was presented by the trial counsel was focused on the drug distribution. It was hammered again and again that the most significant gravamen offense was the 55 years maximum punishment for distribution of drugs. So under Weakman, the Army Service Court did look at it and decided that they were well suited to be able to review the facts and circumstances of this case. We do expect a judicial panel to be able to bifurcate and evaluate what was relevant and what was not, and to separate out what is irrelevant to their sentence reassessment. And there's nothing in the language of the Army Service Court's opinion that indicates they relied at all on any victim. It was relied upon, again, as an aggravating result, a tragic consequence of drug distribution. So, the question is really, did the Army Court satisfy its burden? Did it abuse its discretion? And they did not. They showed their work, so they went through every factor that was outlined in Winkleman and explained that their thought logic and how all of the facts and circumstances of this case were applied to the standards in Winkleman. And I think when you look at the charge sheet and you see that you're acquitted of manslaughter, the plain words do cause kind of a visceral reaction that you would expect to see some credit. But that's just looking at the charge sheet without any supporting evidence behind it.
Counsel, just looking at this from a practical perspective, under the government's theory, the fact that the manslaughter charge was thrown out makes no difference whatsoever in the sentencing determination. So in other words, you're arguing essentially that had he been acquitted of manslaughter at trial, the sentence would have been exactly the same. In other words, there is no sentencing value to the manslaughter. Does that make any sense at all?
I do understand your point, Your Honor. But again, because the charge sheet was drafted as a singular person of conduct, and the element of distribution was in there as a parallel theory of liability. So distribution was specifically charged under specification 3 of charge 2, but it was a necessary element of the charge. So you're going to get the same evidence, and it's going to have the same aggravating impact that it would have on the final sentence after that charge was taken off. So I agree that you would expect to see something if you're just looking at the plain language of the charging decision, but when you look at the facts and circumstances of the case itself, her death caused by manslaughter was not the most aggravating factor. That wasn't what was argued before the court. What was argued was that it was a soldier that was distributing a lot of drugs throughout the barracks to a lot of soldiers and to his teenage girlfriend in the barracks on an army installation, and she wound up dead in his bed. She is a tragic consequence of his distribution and drug
abuse. So what you're saying, I think, in response to Judge Erdman, is that this is a drug case. It's a big drug case. Oh, you got a dead girl over here, but that doesn't make any difference in the sentencing landscape. Is that what you're saying?
No, sir. It is a drug case, and it is a vast drug case with a lot of different incidents.
Well, yeah, that's what you're saying. But you got a dead girl over here. And you're saying that dead girl or no dead girl doesn't make any difference in the sentencing landscape.
No, sir. I think calling it manslaughter or death by a distribution gone bad, that's the part that doesn't make a difference on the sentencing landscape.
Well, was he convicted of any form of homicide? I don't think so. So calling it into manslaughter and calling it something that he wasn't even charged with, I think, is a difference. He wasn't charged with any other form of homicide relating to her death, was he?
Okay. Involuntary manslaughter.
Yeah, I just don't quite understand where the government's going here. Okay. Never mind. Go ahead.
That wasn't a question. Let's look at it from the change in the penalty landscape. Removing the involuntary manslaughter charge reduced the maximum possible punishment from 82 years to 72 years. The appellant was only convicted and sentenced to 70 months at the original trial, which is well within the purview of a drug distribution case. And the Army Court evaluated that as well and evaluated the nature of the drug case and decided that it was an appropriate panel to review a sentence, to engage in a sentence reassessment for this type of case.
In the government's view, what was the most serious charge that was brought against Mr. Bennett?
From the government's view, it was drug distribution.
It wasn't the manslaughter.
No, Your Honor.
Was a secondary charge that was just thrown in?
No, Your Honor. That covered an additional theory of liability, which would have been the crushing of the pill when he distributed the drug to Ms. LK. That was the additional element that took it from just a simple distribution charge, as it was under Specification 3, to an involuntary manslaughter charge. This court disagreed, but that was the government's theory at the charging decision, and that's how, I mean, they covered the same date span and the same nature of the act.
Counsel, did the government at trial break up what it was requesting in terms of a sentence by offense? Do you know?
Yes, Your Honor, they did. And they focused very heavily on the 55 years possible maximum punishment for the distribution itself. So, any other questions? I ask you to consider that the service court showed their work. They adhered to the letter, to the language that was set forth in the standards for sentence reassessments under Winkleman. Under Article 66, we are sentence reassessments with our service courts when they find themselves able to do so. This was the case that was remanded only for legal sufficiency, and based on their opinion, their outlining of how the facts and circumstances of this particular case to reaffirm the sentence as a judge regarding with the utmost deference, as again is articulated in Winkleman, and I ask you to read it.
Thank you, counsel. We now have opportunity for the appellant's rebuttal.
Your Honor, with regard to the gravamen of the offense at trial, the government's sentencing argument kind of says it all. In the beginning and at the end of their sentencing argument, they say this case demands justice. Leah King is dead. She will never celebrate her 17th birthday. That's at JA 215. They say that at the introduction of their sentencing argument and also at the closing. And they also say the accused offense against the person of LK should resonate deeply with the human conscience. This case was about the manslaughter offense and the resulting death.
How many years did they ask for the manslaughter offense, the government?
Your Honor, the government asked for 7 years.
And how many years did they ask for the drug distribution offense?
Your Honor, I believe they asked for approximately the same amount of time.
It was 10 years, wasn't it?
Yes, Your Honor.
So 3 years more.
Yes, Your Honor. And then they asked for 2 years, I believe, for the use offenses. Your Honor, with regards to the applicability of Barrage, although that was a case that dealt with federal sentencing guidelines, they did a plain language analysis. And plain language analysis, regardless of the type of statute, is still a plain language analysis. So we do believe that the analysis that occurred in Barrage with regards to language, with regards to the text, results from or similar such phrases because of, would be applicable in reading the language in 1001b4. With respect to the uncharged misconduct and the bringing in of aggravation evidence under that lens, your Shute, Norris, and Mullins cases are not catch-all bootstrapping. So potentially get to uncharged misconduct, which don't then get to victim impact of uncharged misconduct and go to third and fourth and fifth order of effects. So there's not a bootstrapping when it comes to this court's view of those types of cases. Your Honor, subject to any further questions, no further rebuttal.
Okay, no further questions. Court thanks both counsel. The case is now submitted, and we stand in recess until further order of the court. Thank you very much.
All rise. The court stays adjourned until further order of the court.